Yes. So I'll talk about a recent—not that recent anymore—work with Aki, which he put on the net last December. So you all know that part of the excitement about non-commutative geometry is the fact that we have these soliton solutions, which are singular in the commutative limit. And what we wanted to do essentially was to understand part of the dynamics of these solitons, including what happens to them when we give them some velocity, and then some a better quantum understanding of the solitons. So I'll start, all the stuff that I'm going to talk about is very, very simple. There's nothing complicated. But unfortunately, I'll have to say a few words about this operator formulation of non-commutative geometry, because this is the simplest way to think about these solitons. And after that, everything is really trivial in a sense. Okay, so let me start with... So we know that there are two ways to think about non-commutative geometry. One way is to use the star product, in which we replace each product by this star product, which is defined there. Now, what is nice about this is that it looks very much like ordinary field theory, in the sense that if you want to do perturbation theory, this is a natural way to just, you can repeat exactly what you know from field theory. You just have to put the phrases where you really should. Now, in one respect, this looks like a boring way to do a non-commutative geometry. A different way is to use the operator formulation, in which the theory looks very, very different than ordinary field theory. And as a result, we'll see that this is suitable to find some new non-perturbative solutions. Now, of course, whatever I can describe in this notation, I can also describe in the star product notation, but it is just a little bit more convenient. Okay, so let's start. We have the non-commutative plane, which means that x and y do not commute. We can define a creation and annihilation operator in the following way. And we normalize it in such a way that we have the canonical conservation. Now, the next step is to replace each function of x and y, we have some function like this here, by an operator. And this is one way to do this. We have this integral here. We have this integral here, which gives us an operator of C and C dagger as a function of f of x and y. Now, what is so nice about this is the fact that if we do something like that, then if we add two functions, let's say f and g of x, and we multiply them using a star product, then when we go to the operator, then we just have to multiply them as two matrices. And the other property, which is also very useful, is that the integral of f is just the trace over the relevant operator. Well, this factor here is just to give you the right...
Is it 2 pi theta?
You're worrying about pi? Maybe. Maybe.
No.
There is a way to fix this. I haven't...
But if x commutator advice, I theta is 2 pi theta.
I think it's 2 pi theta, you're right.
Okay. Okay. In any case, what we would like to do is to worry about the, is to not worried that much about phi, but a little bit more about the gauge theory. And in gauge theories, what we have is what is natural to do is to define this capital C and capital C bar. And there is more or less we have something like A plus, maybe there is phi also, but 1 over theta times, this is the creation operator, and this is just the and this is just the so we have maybe even a minus, but I'm not sure. In any case, the reason why this is a natural thing to define is that this is like a covariant derivative. This part of the story is like the derivative, and this is just A. And if you do this, you can write the action, if you choose this gauge, this is the action of 2 plus 1 non-commutative Young-Mens theory. If you choose this gauge, then you end up having something like that, and this is just a quantum mechanics of infinite by infinite matrix. Okay. Now, once we have the action, we can, of course, write down the equation of motions. And this is the equation of motions. This is, we fix the gauge A0 to be zero, and therefore we have also this gauge fixing condition. And now we should start to look for a classical solution for this action. And let me first start by describing the static solutions, and what I'm about to say is based on these 5 papers, and I will not mention exactly who did what because I'm not I forgot about it. Okay, so if this is the equation of motion, you can check that this will solve the equation of motion. Clearly, if this everything here does not depend on time, so this is zero, and we can check that this also vanishes. And you see that here we have infinite by infinite matrix, and here we have m complex parameters, which we would like to claim now are the which we would like to claim will correspond to the location of these vortices on the plane. So what we want to claim is that this solution is just a solution of m magnetic vortices located on the plane, and these L's are just the locations of these vortices. Okay, now one way so we should first of all verify that indeed we have m units of magnetic flux. So we have to compute the field strength, which is defined like this. This is the commutator, and this is just because we add this extra term in the definition. We end up with this expression. And indeed, we know that, as I said before, the integral over f is now theta times the trace of this operator, which is m. And indeed, we have here m unit of magnetic flux. Now, if you look on this expression, then you should immediately say that something is fishy, because f clearly does not depend on L. And therefore, it's very strange to claim. It's very strange to claim that L is the correspond to the location of the vertices. Because the picture that we have is something like that. We have this is the non-commutative plane, and in this example we have 4 vortices. Now clearly if I move them around, then F will change. And as I said, this expression here does not seem to know about this. All the L's are long gone. Okay, so what is wrong here is there's nothing wrong with the solution. What is wrong is with the interpretation. F is not a gauge invariant quantity, so we should better not use it as to define where girls will devote themselves. So what is your engaged environment is something like this operator like Tricef or Tricef squad with this Wilson line tail, and if you check and when you do this Wilson line, I think then you know that you need to put the covariant derivative at the exponent, and the covariant derivative certainly we certainly see the dependence on L, and this is the way we actually verify that these will correspond to the location of the operator of the vortices. Okay. Now you can compute another thing, which is the energy of the of this solution, and you get the following result. And I'm not sure about this pi, but what I am sure about is that it will not depend on LIs, which means that classically there is no force between these solitons. I can move them around, and they are not aware of each other. Okay, now if we have n equal to 4, then we know that we also have six scalars in the adjoint. In this case, we have 7. So it's not n equal to 4, it's n equal to 8 in 3 dimensions. But in any case, in the 16 supercharges, we also have these scalars. And we can turn on these expectation value. And you can verify that it will not change the equation of motion for the electric field, and it will also not change the total flux and the energy of the solution. But there are two important. Yes, sir. We can. Yes.
Those of vortex
strains. Right? Right, yes. So in 4 dimensions, this vortex becomes strained. Okay, so what is important about these scalars is that, first of all, the classical moduli space now is much larger, but what is more important for this talk is the fact that, we can stabilize the soliton if we turn on a large enough phi squared. That is, if we don't turn on any phi, you can compute these small fluctuations about this solution, and you find one tachyon, which in string theory is coming from the component, so this would be the 1-3 string. And the tachyon mass is minus 1 over theta. Now, if I turn on this phi, then I can shift it by phi squared. So clearly, if I take phi to be large enough, then this is I make the tachyon. I can make the. What was what?
Is it known what the fate of these solitons were before you turn on the
phi? Sure. So you see, what you're doing here is you're fighting the natural way of things, right? You are squeezing.
You want the flux to spread.
Exactly. So you can. Okay. Now it turns out that there is a very, very simple way to generalize these solutions and to let them start propagate with some velocity. And essentially, all you have to do, it's quite trivial if you look on the equation of functions. So this is the equation of motions. Clearly, if I add a constant velocity term, it will not change anything. And this is what we did. And you see that you can add different velocities. To, each vortex can have a different velocity, so you're not just moving all of these guys around together. And clearly, you haven't changed any, or you haven't changed the total magnetic flux, so this integral is still m. But you can compute now the energy and you see that you get this extra term here, which is coming from the kinetic energy, and you also have a momentum, which is just a pointing vector. Now, you see that it's indeed very simple, but there are two conclusions which are non-trivial, which is the following. First of all, before we saw that there is no static force between these vortices, now we see that there is no, classically there is no force which depends on the velocity as well. This expression does not depend on the distance between vortices. What is more important is that this is nothing but a non-relativistic dispersion relation. So there is nothing special about v equal to 1. We can give them a velocity as large as we want. And I will not say too much about this at this stage. I will talk about this towards the end of the talk. But it is, I just want to know that we are just talking here about space-space non-commutativity. We are not introducing any space-time non-commutativity. Yes?
This might be an important point. So these equations are correct for any V. These are not just approximations for V.
For any V. For any V, yes. Let me just write, put the action, so...
Oh, okay.
You see, this is the... Oops. This is the action. So you don't have any... This is, you know, it's like two derivatives. It's V squared. That's all there is to it. As simple as that. There's nothing... Okay, so I'll go back to this traveling faster than light soon, but let's before talk about some quantum properties of these solutions. So we would like to see how much of these properties will survive the quantum corrections, and in particular we saw that we have this huge moduli space, but we know that these are not non-BPS solutions, so clearly quantum effects should do something to this moduli space. And in particular, we see that we have a potential that goes like this. We have this, this is the tachyon field, which gets massive when we turn on phi. But when the tachyon field is zero, we have here this, and we can change phi freely. Right, this is just a moduli. This is just the flat direction. And what we would like to see is how much of this, what will happen when we take quantum corrections into account. So we know what we have to do. We have to integrate out T and to see what is the effective potential for phi. Now, clearly we cannot do this everywhere because we have here a tachyon when phi is small. So here, this is the potential as function of T and phi. So here I have this tachyon singularity, so I cannot integrate T here, but I can integrate T in this regime to see what will be the potential. Now this is a fairly messy calculation because we have all of these fermions and we have lots of fields that we have all these determinants that we have to fix, but fortunately enough, it was done by developers some time ago in a different context. And what they were interested in was, this was in the early days of the metrics model, which people were scattering gravitons out of M2 brains in the infinite momentum frame, which is exactly what we have here if you do apply u-duality. This is exactly the same problem that we have here, where the infinite momentum is just the large B field. Okay. In any case, you can translate the result into into non-commutative variables, you find the following expression, which tells you that the flood direction is indeed lifted. And what will happen is that if you put soliton somewhere with large phi, it will eventually roll down and it will hit the tachyon point. Now, this means that quantum mechanically this object is unstable, of course, but from this potential you can compute the lifetime of this solution, and you see that you can tune it. If you take phi to be large in units of non-commutativity, you can make this lifetime to be essentially as large as you want.
Again, lambda was what?
Lambda is the two script, G squared times. Huh? Okay, now, so in the old days, what you would do, you would now start to check all the higher order corrections, but now we don't have to do this anymore. At least when we have enough supersymmetry, we can go directly to large coupling. We have a dual description in terms of supergravity, and we should just ask ourselves what is the dual thing that we are looking at. And the calculation will be very simple because this is just Born-Ifeld, just classical supergravity calculation. There is nothing too complicated about this. So let me just say a few words about what is the dual of this vortex in supergravity and how we should approach it. So first of all, the supergravity, it looks something like in the commutative directions, nothing happened. We have the familiar ADS-like shape, which goes as we go to the boundary. In the non-commutative plane, it starts growing like an ADS, but then it starts to shrink. We have something like that. Now, the vortex is in four dimensions. This is a string which is stretched in the 0-1 plane, which in supergravity would be just a D1 string, which is again stretched like this in the 1 plane. Now, if you just look on the metric, you would maybe guess that there cannot be any finite mass gap here, because you see that as you go to infinity, the size of this string is getting larger and larger. So clearly, it will cost more and more energy to go to infinity. But this is not entirely correct, because we have also the dilaton and the two forms. And if you plug all the dependence into the Born-Ifeld action, you will find the following expression. So this is just what you get from the fact that the string is getting larger. This is the contribution from the two form. And you see that at infinity they will cancel each other, and you will indeed end up with a finite mass gap. Now, what is interesting about this mass gap is that this is exactly the result that you get in free field theory. And this is a non-BPS object. So the question is, why is this mass protected by, what protects this mass? And there is a very simple way to understand this, which is the following. So the solution starts looking at the infrared very much. You can neglect, for small u, you can neglect this term, and it looks exactly like ADS. But as you take u to be larger and larger, the solution starts looking more and more like the new horizon of, D1 brain stretched along the 0-1 directions and smeared in these two directions. So now what we are doing is we are just putting an extra D1 like this, which is clearly BPS in this background. And this is why at infinity all of this is protected. Right.
Can you see also on the filter that it becomes BPS for the pipe?
Yes, you can. I'll talk about in slightly different way. So So we see that essentially what is happening is that we really, this is what we had if we didn't have any non-commutativity. If we just push this T1 brand to infinity, it would cost more and more energy. Now we have this finite mass gap. And it's nice to make a connection with what we know in ADS2, because we know that in ADS2 we have this long strings which can propagate with finite amount of energy all the way to the boundary. And also in ADS3, the proper length of these strings is really going to infinity, but we have this cancellation coming from the Chern-Simon term. Now, okay. We can do, in this case, a little bit more. We can expand around infinity, and we can, so we have this mass gap term, which is that term, and we finding this first correction, which again is exactly the same as the one loop field theory result. But of course, as U is getting smaller and smaller, then there are other terms which are very different than what we find in field theory. In particular, we clearly find no tachyon here. It will just continue to roll down all the way to U equal to zero. Anything else? So if we think about the analogy with ADS3, then we know that in the ADS3 CFT2 story, these long strings are very important, right? We know that the theory which is living on these long strings is the Liouville theory. And it's a very natural question to ask you, what is the generalization, what is going on here? And there is a very simple way to answer this question. You just need to consider fluctuations around the solution. So we take, I listed here just two such fluctuations, but you can think of all the relevant fluctuations that you can put on this string. You plug this into the Born-N selection, and then you take this U0 to infinity, which means that you are looking at near the boundary. Well, the correction to or the variation of direction turn out to be as simple as that. This is just 1+1 supering Mills theory, where the coupling constant is the original coupling constant divided by the non-commutativity. And you see that what is happening is that effectively taking U naught to infinity plays the role of taking alpha prime to zero in the usual way of taking the decoupling limit. So at the end of the day, near the boundary, the effective description of this long string is nothing but 1+1 field theory. And from the field theory side, you can understand this in the following way. We have this, we have the string, and we have the background. So we have 1-1 strings, and we have 3-3 strings, and they talk to each other through the 1-3 string. But the mass of this 1-3 string is going to infinity when phi is going to infinity. So we are really ending up with some two-dimensional theory which is living within a four-dimensional theory. So the statement is very simple, but yet surprising, that in non-commutative theories above a certain mass gap, we find in four-dimensional non-commutative theories, we find two-dimensional ordinary field theories. And if this is correct, then this should have, or this might have, interesting application on the phases of the theory, because we know that in a four-dimensional theory, for example, the entropy goes like T cubed. In two-dimensional theory, it goes only like T. Yes?
These two-dimensional theories are also Kiani, right? So why would you expect them to be?
It's not, when phi right. goes to infinity, it
well,
stops.
Because it still sort of will be rolling.
It will be rolling,
so
sure.
You think it will still contribute?
Right, but the time it will take them to roll down will be huge, right? So it's not...
The velocity will probably start increasing as they roll.
Let's wait. This is just a motivation. We'll see that it's very... So in any case, I would say that something interesting might happen, and I'll show that it did it up. And then we can...
You can't play the one three-string decoupling again. You're in the near horizon limit, right? So sometimes you haven't left the three-string throw.
Right.
Why are the
right.
one
three-string? Because... how was it? So from the field theory side, you just have this kind of potential, and this T is really the one string, the one three strings, right? And you see that its mass is going to infinity when phi goes to infinity. Now, if you ask from the ADS CFT point of view, then this is essentially this is the usual story, right? If you take a brain and you put it within ADS and you take U to infinity, then it will decouple. This is just a statement that's becoming less and less relevant as you go to the boundary, right? So usually in ADS you cannot put a D1 string, but you can think about the following. Suppose that I have ADS and I put D3 brain. Okay, as I take U, right, so you have this is the trajectory where this is some U, right? Now, as I take U to be larger and larger, then this will be coupled from the rest of the excitations which are living here. Right? So this is just the same statement. U is just phi. Okay, so I said that it might be important for the possible phases of the theory. So let me just... remind you what we have in four dimensions. So in four dimensions, we have three kind of regimes. We have the small toothed coupling regime, where we're doing perturbation theory. We have the large toothed coupling regime, and where we take also the dual toothed coupling to be much larger than one, which is just n over g squared. Now, of course, this is possible only in the large n limit, and in this case, we have the supergravity dual. Now, we have the third regime in which the dual toothed coupling is much smaller than one, and in that regime, we are just using the S-dual perturbation theory. Now, the non-commutative version of all of this is people like to call this regime the NCOS limit, or the NCOS theory. And what I would like to show now is that there is much more to this regime than just NCOS, and that NCOS is just the low energy limit of something much more complicated. So before I'll show you that, I'll just mention that if you take the NCOS limit, then as you know, it involves taking GS to infinity, which is the first thing that this cannot be the proper description of the theory of the UV, and we'll see what is the right description of the UV. Okay. So I would like to claim that the right description of the UV is always a supergravity that is in ADS. In the usual case, we have ADS, which is a good description only in this regime. Here I would like to claim that it will be valid also in that regime.
The yes. claim was that there was an effective open string coupling that was weak.
Yes.
So, but you're questioning that because there's a closed string coupling.
Right.
So then this NCOS has some exponential density of the spectrum. So we will reproduce it or we will give a different prediction.
So this exponential density was resolved. I will talk about this in a second, okay? Okay, so I claim that the relevant description of the EUV is always supergravity, and let's see how this comes about. We know when we can trust supergravity. We can trust supergravity when the curvature is small. We can compute the curvature. The curvature angles like 1 over the square root of the tooth coupling. And this, of course, means that we can do supergravity. We can trust supergravity only. We cannot trust supergravity in this regime. But as far as the curvature is concerned, we can trust supergravity both in these two regimes. Now, usually in ODS, what is happening is that you cannot do, we cannot trust supergravity in this regime because the dilaton will kill you. The dilaton is getting very large there. But what is happening here is that the dilaton behaves different. It's not a constant anymore. You have this term, which in regime 3 is very, very large, but you have this additional non-commutative kind of contribution, which will, no matter how large this is, eventually if you take u to be large enough, this will go to zero. So it is always the case that near the boundary, both the curvature and the dilaton are small. And so regime 3, as I said, is always there. You don't need to take any large n limit. Right? I can always have, if I take the original coupling constant to be much larger than 1, then this will be much smaller than 1. So therefore, we conclude that this is correct also for a U1 gauge theorem, non-commutative gauge theorem. Okay, so the phases of the theory which I claim now are the following. This is the temperature, and I claim that at the deep UV we have always supergravity. And there is an intermediate regime in which we have this liberated strings, which I will say a few words about this in the next transparency. And only the deep infrared we have what people like to call the NCOS kind of description. Now, you know that if this for this to make sense, we need to show that there is no overlap between the different descriptions, right? That in particular, that there are no liberated strings living in the supergravity regime. There should be a way to distinguish between all of these descriptions. And what I would like to show now is that this is the case. But, yes.
Do you know how some effective couplings run in the NCOS regime?
Effective coupling?
The transition is somehow associated with some strong coupling, some coupling. Yeah.
No, here the transition is, I will talk about this transition. So maybe I should say a few words about this. So, about this transition. And forget for 1 second about supergravity. And the way these Gapser, Gukov, Klebanov, and Germani and Witten explain this transition is as follows. You have a theory, you have these strings, and you can ask yourself whether the theory would like to liberate the strings or it doesn't. So clearly, these strings are just the vortices, these vortex strings that we talked about before, or the S-dual version of them. And, well, it certainly costs energy to liberate them because they have tension. So you have to pay this amount. This is L times the tension of these strings. But on the other hand, you have entropy that you gain from them. You have this T times S in the free energy, which you gain. And certainly we saw that there are lots of degrees of freedom which are living on them, which means that there is an entropy associated with them. And this gave them this minus T squared term. And so they concluded that they didn't know about this term. So they concluded that, that when T is small, we are in the NCOS phase. When T is large, we start to liberate the strings. And they just assumed that this will continue to work for arbitrarily large temperature. Now, one thing that they didn't take into account is the fact that when you turn on temperature, you also lift the flow direction. And essentially what is happening, and this is related to what Ofer asked, what is happening is that when you turn on the temperature, essentially what they computed here was to say, we have a potential, we have a certain mass gap, which goes like that, and here, if the string will go from here all the way to infinity, we'll gain a certain amount of entropy, we'll have to pay this price, and that all there is to it. But what is happening is that in this kind of, this is, in a sense, almost a flat direction, but when you turn on temperature, you actually have to take into account the fact that you shift this a little bit. Now this is a little bit when the temperature is small, but you have to be careful, and you can do it either from using field theory kind of calculation or in supergravity. It's very simple. You just need to replace d not naught by this factor, and then you find that the mass gap is the original term that you had before plus this t to the form term. And so altogether, the free energy, for the free energy, you end up having this expression. And now the question is when F is negative or not. Now this is a very simple equation to solve. You just need to define X as T squared in the non-commutative units. You ask yourself when this is larger than, when this is smaller than zero. And first of all, you can very easily convince yourself that for this to have such a solution, g squared has to be larger than n. And this immediately tells you that you must be in regime 3. There are no liberated strings in these two regimes. And this is, of course, this makes lots of sense because from the non-commutative point of view, these strings are really non-perturbative solutions. So for them to contribute something, you should go into a very strong coupling regime. Now, even if you are in this regime, you see that only for a finite temperature, F will be negative. And this is what you get. And if you just plug this in, you find that this will exactly agree with this kind of picture that is the liberated strings will stop being free exactly at the point where the curvature of the supergravity is becoming of order one. Okay, so this is the so that's the way it goes. Yes.
Whether you answered the question I asked before. So if I'm just a low energy observer in N0S and just see these strings,
yes.
Is there some coupling that becomes strong in the UV that tells me that my, you know, what coupling becomes strong in the UV that tells me that my description breaks?
Argandon temperature. This is here, this is the argandon temperature.
So from the N0S standard anti-Quinton type talking there?
No, because you don't have closed tanks.
So something, well, that's sort of the standard habitable in typical string theory. So what sort of would be the indication? You know, some coupling has to become strong, or you know, some tankiness has to, you know, something has to go wrong with that.
Right. So there are different possibilities, right? One thing is that something that typically has no expectation value condenses, right? And this is what is happening here. We have condensation of these strings, right? If you think from these...
What's the order parameter from the NCOS?
Order parameter. I know what is the disorder. I don't know what is the order.
Well,
in any case, you have a phase transition, right? You start with no expectation value and you go to...
I agree, but usually it tells you that in one description, you know, before the phase transition, there was something going wrong as we approach the energy will do the phase transition. I'm just trying to understand what those long terms are.
Why you are not happy with Argedon?
Because we have similarity to energy.
What is wrong with this?
If
you don't know about these guys starting to condense, you will just say that.
I guess I want something for the purposes of something like having a running coupling that increases in the UV. For example, for the purposes of, maybe in QCD there's a formal argument that the coupling is 1 over n, but actually there's some running. Energy-dependent running. So I'm sort of asking whether there's something.
But I think that here, in a sense, the situation is much better because we know what is happening to the free energy, and that's at the end of the day, this is what you want to know, right? All of these are just tools to avoid really confronting the question: what is happening to the free energy as function of t?
Okay, think about more.
I think that. What? Okay. Okay, so let me just summarize this the relevant. So what is the phase diagram we have? So for smokeless coupling, we can do perturbation theory for any temperature. For large but not too large toothed coupling, we have to use supergravity. For very large toothed coupling, the regime where we define the theory, that is in the regime where we have the maximal entropy, we should use supergravity only as we flow to the infrared. We have these liberated and the NCRS kind of phases. Okay. So let's conclude now with a discussion about all of this causality issues and traveling faster than light kind of issues. So. We know that if we have a Lorentz invariance, then clearly nothing can propagate faster than light, right? Now, when we break a Lorentz invariance, especially when we break it at a we have some non-locality scale, which in our case, this is the square root of theta, the non-commutativity scale, you might think that, okay, the theory is not local at such a short distances, then you can propagate faster than light at this non-locality scale. But what we found here is that there is no bound on the distance this vortex solution can travel faster than light. It can travel from here to the next galaxy, and there seems to be nothing to prevent it from doing so. Which means that there might be problems with causality, and what I would like to convince you now is that this is not the case in this theory, and that the theory is smart enough to avoid this, even though we can do so. Okay, so let's say that this is the rest frame. We have this is the frame in which we have only space non-commutativity, and now. We are sending this vortex to travel faster than light, let's say in this direction. Now, from the point of view of two guys which are moving with respect to this frame at some velocity, this is really traveling from the present to the past. So if this is the trajectory of these guys, then this is the constant time lines of this in this frame, the frame of this, the moving frame. Now, usually if I had a parity for my disposal, then I could have concluded that if I can send a message from this guy to that guy, from the present of this guy to the past of this guy in one direction, then parity will tell me that I can do the same also in the other direction, and then I could send a signal to that point, let's say, and clearly I can close the timeline and I can start having all of these problems. But when you boost to this frame, what you have done, you also introduced a non-commutativity in the t x plane, and therefore you actually broken parity, and you can ask yourself what is happening to the signal which you send in the other direction. And actually there is a bound on this signal, and this signal cannot propagate as fast as you want. And it turns out that the bound is exactly such that the signal send you, which you send from B, will eat C, which is always to the future of A. So you can never go back in time.
Why is there a bound in the original observer?
Which is from this?
Yeah.
Because you see, what is happening is that in this frame, what I can do, I can send signal as fast as I want, but always to the future, right?
Yeah. There's a preferred frame.
Right.
And things always travel to the future in that.
In that frame. And once it's always traveled to the future in one frame, you can show that it must always travel to the future. Not in any frame, but for any observer in any frame. That is not saying this right. You can send information to the past, but not to yourself. It will always be to your own future. Now, you might, of course, not buy all of this, especially if you don't know anything about the way we derive non-commutative theories from string theory. But once you understand the relevant limit that you have to take in string theory, you see that all of this is very makes lots of sense, and it's actually fairly simple. So the way it goes, let me just remind you, we start with, let's say this is a D3 brain, and we have a huge magnetic field. And as a result, if we have here some open string which is attached to this D3 brain, then the boundary condition, the boundary terms on this guy will be modified. And when B is very large, it will be modified in such a way that effectively this string will be really propagating in a different kind of metric, which Zeiberg and Witten like to call the open string metric, which is much larger than the original closed string metric. Now, if I think about this, the vortex, so the vortex in the non-commutative plane is just a point, so we have here two points like this. Now, the strings which are propagating on this point, they couldn't care less about the huge B field because the B field is transverse to them. Yes, it's transverse to them, and so nothing is, so it does not affect the boundary conditions. So in effect, these guys are really propagating in the closed string metric. And so all of this non-relativistic dispersion relation that we find is nothing but just a statement that we have these objects which have relativistic dispersion relation in the closed string metric, but when I translate this into the open string metric, then because in the time direction I haven't done anything, I just changed things in the non-commutative plane, the dispersion relation which I end up getting in the open string metric is non-relativistic. So as far as string theory is concerned, all of this is really trivial. What is not trivial is the fact that we can describe these objects which are propagating in the closed string metric after we've taken the decoupling limit. This is what is so strange about this from the string theory point of view. Okay. So let me stop by presenting this amusing relation between sci-fi and string theory. So I think that I'll stop here.
Yes. So that picture that you drew regarding, you cannot have closed term like curve, would you be able to identify the x-axis to an S1?
Which one to what? Oh, yes. Ah, this is a very good question. So you see that, so you want to put this on a toes.
Yeah.
So, yes, but you see what will happen. This will, so let's say that I cut it here, right? So that point will be identified with that point. So it will continue and it will hit it here, right?
Well, there's, it seems to me that there's a perspective of the green guy from which it seems that the signal has traveled to the past.
Oh, of course. Of course, here it's traveling to the past, but when it will, so if I, what you want to do is to identify this point with
yeah.
that point, right? So if I do something like that,
oh, okay.
then this point will be point here and it will continue to here and it will hit it.
Right, I thought what Rafael wanted to do was identify the shift in the time direction so that you're...
shift in the time direction.
I should look at the green lines.
Right, but then I'm really okay. So the okay, let's put it like this. If you start with the in this frame and you try to identify whatever you want to do right in this frame, then clearly you can, okay, all the problems that you can you will have directly, you will see them at this frame, right? You can clearly identify here 2 points in such a way that you will close a time like this, right? It's not a problem, it's just not legal, and it will look bad also in this frame. But there isn't, as far as I can see, I don't see any kind of identification which makes sense in this frame, which will not make sense in that frame. But maybe I'm mistaken.
So let me see, from the point of view of effective field theory, well, so you've got a preferred frame determined by the, I guess, the non-commutativity parameter, and it's just the fact that that's sort of irrelevant at long distances that tells you that that from, well, for most excitations, you still have a Lorentz invariant.
So, Sanae, so what is the density of states at high energy as hyperbolic?
It's T cubed. T, yes, and the entropy goes like T cube, so it's A to the V T cube. And this you can the way you derive this is you adjust, where is it? Yes, you adjust at large temperature, you're just using a supergravity, you find the near extremal solution and you compute the area for a given temperature. And you find that the entropy, that the area goes like T cube.
So what happens with the exponential density that you expect in NCOS? It's valid only up to...
It's valid. So this has nothing... So this was resolved by, in a sense, by Gapser et al. When they noticed that you have this phase of liberated strength, right? Because the question is what is happening at this temperature, not what is happening at that temperature. And once you reach this temperature, you start to liberate all of these things. Yes?
Is there an issue of normalizing the velocity? So one of your the things that sees the open stream metric, you start coupling to loops of the solitons that move much faster. Don't you like, you know, normalize the velocity of the...
What do you mean coupling? What are the loops of solitons?
Well, these are very small solitons, so they don't have any form factor suppression in loops, right? Yeah. It sounds like a usual monopole that doesn't couple strongly in perturbation theory because it has a form factor suppression.
Well, I think that what we you see, you have just the vortex, right? You don't have any Coulomb-like interaction.
You also don't have an anti-vortex.
Okay. That is also.
Okay.
particles of that antiparticle. I mean, non-relativistic theories you can ask. Right?
Yeah. So I was saying that NCOS does not decouple from the bulk beyond certain temperature.
Only if you think of ADS as not decoupling from the bulk. The decoupling in the Malvasena limit, right, is that you decouple a certain supergravity from all the rest at infinity, right? So that supergravity description is a supergravity which is the near horizon of equilibrium in that limit, with the B-fields and all of this. So this regime certainly decouples from the regime which is...
Let us think of finite.
Finite n, yes.
Yes.
Yes. Finite n, but large coupling. Okay.
Finite so n, finite.
This regime is valid only. This phases is only what I call the regime 3, in which the toothed coupling is large. So you can take n to be 2 if you want, but you have to compensate by large coupling constant. And in that regime, I claim that at the UV of supergravity will be a good approximation.
Other questions? Well, thanks, everybody.